All right, good morning, everybody. Crazy day so far for me. Hopefully everybody is doing well. We have a hopefully special guest here this morning with us. We will try to get you guys up on stage. I know there were people up on stage as I was going through the music, which that's what I usually use the opening music to do, is just kind of rearrange things. Thanks for the thumbs up there, Chivas. I'm glad you can hear me. Got Coleman up here. Awesome. Just want to make sure the spaces are working okay, because this has been buggy lately, not just for me, but for others as well. And so want to welcome you to Bitcoin Veteran Spaces number 233, where we're going to talk about some Bitcoin today. And hopefully we will have Neil Flesher with us and be able to talk about modern chains. But before we get started, I'll introduce myself as your host, Bob Van Kirk. We do have AC up here, Texas Toast, Coleman. Hopefully we get Neil back. I know he hasn't done spaces before, so I think he was checking on his audio. Hopefully we'll have him this morning. Otherwise, we'll just banter about stuff. But today is Thursday, July 31st. This is the last day of July. And your reminder to buy some sats today. Let's see what the time chain is telling us. Looks like we are at block height number 907,956, with the last block being found 20 seconds ago. And we're getting an exchange price of $118,500, which means you can still pick up 844 sats for each US dollar. And the fees are ultra low. 3 sats per V-byte. Looks like we have the hash rate coming down a little bit from last week when Mining Goblin was throwing those stats in there. We're just under 900 exahash. But overall, it's gone up from earlier this year and last year. So here's your friendly reminder as well. To run a node, it's the node runners that keep this thing going and keep the ledger available. Guys, if you would go ahead and share the space, we'd love to get more people in here. You can do that by hitting that little purple pill in the bottom right and then retweeting the space or reposting the space. If you can, leave a comment in there as well. Tell me how ugly I am, so that this is why I have a face for radio. And if you'd like to come up and tell me that in person, I would encourage it. Please hit that little microphone button in the bottom left. Would love to banter with you this morning. And, we do have Neil here. Neil, do you want to give us a mic check before we hop into it?
Yeah. Can you guys hear me just fine?
Man, that's perfect. Seems like you've been doing this forever. So awesome. Thanks for, joining us. Again, guys, we like to have fun on the show. It's Thursday, and we do talk about serious topics, but like to have a good time as well. So we'll keep it light and hopefully easy conversation for you guys to listen to this morning. If you're listening to us live, we do appreciate you joining us, as always, and appreciate all the guys on stage. Before we get to Neil, I'm going to give him an introduction here in a minute, but before we get to him, did want to say good morning to some of the folks that are up here. Let's start with Texas Toast. How you doing this morning, sir?
Doing well. Watching the grass grow. All good.
Hey, get out there and touch that grass too. Don't just watch it grow. AC, how you doing, sir?
Morning, guys. Another beautiful day in Bitcoin.
AC, I do want to touch on this sad story that I saw you commented on. where a gentleman, unfortunately, did have his Bitcoin stolen from him. Maybe he made a mistake. And so maybe we can learn from that mistake. And I'd like to touch on that a little bit today before we do hop in with our guest. But I did also want to welcome back to the show, Coleman. How you doing, brother? Good to see you.
Hey, guys. Good morning. Hope everyone can hear me loud and clear. Bob, I just want to make everybody aware. I think you're a very handsome man. I don't think you have a face for radio. No homo. But anyways, no, everything's been going great with me. Busy, staying busy, enjoying the summer, not really caring for the Texas heat, but life goes on.
Yeah, that humidity is really the killer. The heat, you know, my friends in Arizona tell me the dry heat's not a problem. So whether you believe that or not, we're happy to have you up on the stage. Let's do this. Let's introduce our, I would say, humble guest. We've just been going back and forth. Haven't had any in real life conversations, but we've been sending some messages back and forth. I did begin reading his book, and admittedly, I've not gotten through it yet just due to my other obligations with family, business, etc. So, want to introduce everybody to Neil Flesher. Thanks so much for coming up. So Neil has a background that I think everybody in this space will be interested in. He enlisted originally in the infantry and was offered an appointment to West Point, and he did take it. He studied philosophy and, you know, had good grades, did all that stuff, became an Apache pilot and flew for 8 years, did two tours of combat in Iraq, and had over 2 years in command. He left the Army for family and ended up earning a master's degree in philosophy. So smart dude, and really look forward to discussing these things about his journey, but then also what this has brought out in this book that he has written called Modern Chains. And so, it seems like Army life is, a lot of people know Army life can be very stressful and does take you away from family. But I wonder, like, Neil, if we can maybe start it off with how do you see the Army and your experience and that stress, maybe with finances and other things, being away from family? How did that contribute to maybe your path? Or if you want to go a different direction with it, you don't have to answer that question directly, but how did we come to this point for you? How did you get to Bitcoin?
Yeah, so I mean, like you're talking about, Army life is significantly different than, you know, civilian life. And while it does come with this whole, all this baggage, the trade-off though is like, it does completely insulate you from most financial stress. Like, you don't have to worry about your food or your clothing or your housing or, you know, insurance or anything like that. So it's like, for me, I really did kind of get drawn in. Like, I appreciated the comfort. Like, I didn't have to think about money. And so I just didn't. I just had a very, very simple kind of approach to it. It's just like, I would just work hard and earn money and get on through my life. But when I got out of the Army, and being a husband, being a father, and for the first time really having to deal with real world economics, you know, like the economic reality, it just like, it completely broke my approach. Like, that strategy of just like, oh, just work hard and everything will work out. It just like, that wasn't the case. So that's kind of how I came, you know, to this whole kind of money question and what is money. And I fell down that rabbit hole and started going down, you know, all the economics and trying to figure that out. But it's just, quite frankly, it's just all theory, and it's just a bunch of crap that doesn't actually, like, all these economic theories, they grasp partial truths and they're kind of right here and they're kind of right there. But like, as a philosopher, like, I wanted the whole answer. I like, nothing was really satisfying. So that's where I was like, okay, well, I'll use my philosophy. I'm going to go back and answer that question philosophically from first principles. Like, I'm going to ground this question in metaphysical bedrock. That's kind of how I approached it. So going back to Aristotle and Aquinas and, you know, seeing, well, how did they answer this question? And I mean, it's funny because, I mean, thousands of years ago, Aristotle's talking about, you know, the material properties of money, like the material objects, like all the saleability and like all the things, all the catchphrases we hear all around in Bitcoin space. Like, he's talking that. He's talking their formal functions, medium of exchange, store value, unit of account. He's talking about how it takes people like creating money. Like, it's not some money is not just some natural category. Like, it's created by human beings in our minds. Like, we create it, you know, so it's like through that act of exchange. And then he's also talking about how, well, money's final cause is it actually forms the societal bonds between people. Like, money is how a society connects to each other. And this is thousands of years ago. It just, he lays it out so simply. And I found that completely, it was really powerful. Like, trying to dig through or make my way through this economic swamp to then just have like a nice road directly to where I wanted to go. Like, that was such a powerful thing for me. But, the big aha realization of putting all that together is that money springs from morality. Like, it's ethics before economics. The morality actually drives the macro. And when you understand that, like, I don't know, it just like, as applied to Bitcoin, people look at its price action, look at the volatility and its performance, and they can't, they're like, I don't get it. It looks so different, so crazy. But that's if you're only looking at it economically and you don't understand that it's actually the ethics behind it. That's the why. Like, I don't care about the what. Economics is like, it describes, it says what's happening, and we can model it and we can do all this stuff. And it's like, do all of our math graphs, and that's fine and dandy. And there's a place for that. And for some people, like, that's what draws them in. But it's not, it actually puts the cart before the horse. Like, I want to know what's driving it, and that's the ethics. So that, I don't know if that's kind of a, if you wanted to say anything to that, or if you just want me to keep on going.
Yeah, no, it's really cool, because I think too often we don't, you know, a lot of this stuff, the people who get a lot of the big follows, I think, are the people who are piecing together a lot of the data. And that's what seems to, I think, sometimes drive people, and we get into arguments about it. And some people think some metrics are valuable and others aren't. But I like that your approach was, you know, more of a first principles. And I did invite Tomer up here, so thanks for coming up as well, sir, because Tomer has a lot of input, I think, in the space, valuable insights and input on Bitcoin and philosophy. And he does this Sunday space. And so I thought, you know, maybe having him, his brilliant mind together with Neil's might be a really interesting conversation. We'll see if we can get there. But I do think that this idea of going back to first principles again and building, you know, kind of almost a originating or a foundational idea on things, and not focusing so much on the math, but focusing more on, these basics. And you called it simple, Neil. Can you kind of just talk a little bit around that? Like, how did you see it? Did you see it like in full clarity right away because of how simple it was? Or were you just looking at it through the lens of, man, all these people out there are just complicating it so much, and he's just speaking this original truth? Can you kind of chime in on that a little bit?
Yeah. So I think we say first principles a lot, but most people aren't philosophers, haven't studied metaphysics. Like, metaphysics is the first principle. Like, if we start at any any higher level, if we start at like anthropology or epistemology, like if we talk about what a human being is or what knowledge is or what an economy is, if we're starting at any higher level and we're like, oh, I'm building from a principle, it's like, well, is that principle really the first? And it's like, so that's why going to Aristotle is like grounding it in metaphysics. Like that's the first principle. Like that's kind of maybe not the first principle, but like that's the level you can go. So I'm going to take it there because I can't. Like I am a philosopher. That's what I train to do. So that's what I'm going to apply that skill to this. But like I didn't like, so I'm still just like learning about money. Like I didn't really even know about Bitcoin at all through this process while as I'm making this. So it's like, we want to talk about what is simple for money. So it's like, so money is a measure of value, right? That's what we say. But it's like, oftentimes we are when we use that, we use value and money and we kind of interchange them, but there's a, like metaphysically, there's a distinction. Like we can't conflate the monetary object with like the real value that is stored inside of it. So it's really important when we're talking economics and we're talking monetary policy to be able to identify, are we talking about the objects that contain value or are we talking about like the creation of value? Because we'll unpack value then a little bit. And in the book, I use Marx and Mises as kind of like the bookends of how you can, the two different approaches and how they both fail and how it's really putting them both together to get this whole understanding of what value is. The philosophical word for it is like hylomorphic. It's like this answer of how do they both come together in unison to create a composite? But like value is a measure of motion towards an aim. So it's like, well, what does that mean? It's like, so you have to have a subject determining an aim. They have to energize an object that moves towards that aim that has the potential to actualize that end. And as philosophical as like, I won't try to get any deeper than that, but like, if you can just like make sense of it, like I'm a person, I have needs, I have, wants, I look at something, I have a target. I'm trying to make something happen to satisfy my needs, and I have to expend energy to create work to actualize what I need. It's like that's what we call value. You know, so your value is your work. Your value is productive energy. And like when you understand that that's how value is created and that's how it relates to money, like we have this monetary object, we're creating value in the world and then we store it in monetary objects and exchange it with one another. Like that's what money is. So at that point in my studies, I'm like, okay, I understand money now philosophically to a metaphysical level. Well, what does that mean for our economic reality today? What does that mean for debasement? Like when I look at debasement now, it's like, okay, well, what does that mean? Technically, they're expanding the money supply. When they print the dollar, right, they're printing these, like they're not creating any value. They're printing these, they're creating an empty monetary object, but then they're treating it as if it was a regular monetary object that already had value in it. So it's like what that does, I mean, since dollars are fungible and we treat them all equal, whatever value is in an existing dollar, when you create a new dollar, it siphons, it extracts that value until there's equilibrium between all existing dollars. So like the creation, the artificial expansion of that money supply extracts all that productive value. And it's like, okay, so it's like, that's what debasement's technically doing. And then I ask, okay, well, what does that mean morally? And, you know, Aristotle, like when we define something, we're stripping away all of its accidents until we're left with just this formal essence. It's like basically its function. And that's when it clicked for me that it's like, oh, wow. So debasement and slavery, they share the exact identical formal essence. So I don't need to physically dominate you to extract your productive energy. I can now use this dollar, which is universally scalable. Like it's the most scalable instrument of enslavement ever. It's like the most efficient tool probably ever created. Like it literally, just by holding a dollar, you are in chains. Like in that same, you are being extracted from by just holding the dollar when they debase. So it's like, that's not, at first, when I ever heard someone say that, like, debasement, slavery, I kind of scoffed at it. Like, oh, that's just clickbait. That's just hyperbole. But coming from it, you know, building it up from this metaphysical foundation, it's like, no, that's not metaphorically. It's not an analogy. That it's formal slavery. Like there's literally no other definition for what that is. And it's at that point of me making that connection of like debasement is literally slavery. That's the first time that I kind of got to Bitcoin. So I had this moral clarity about the problem of debasement and seeing it for exactly for what it was. And then I started to get into Bitcoin. So for me, I got Bitcoin really, really fast, but it's not because I'm super smart and can calculate and crunch a bunch of numbers. And I'm like, oh, this is the optimal investment and blah, 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 blah. I'll get all these returns. And like, I morally recognized what it was, like what it solved. And it filled the moral, the ethical failure. And I knew that by solving the ethical problem, you are, unethical money yields unethical fruit. So it's like, okay, well, ethical money will yield ethical fruit. So that's literally all it takes for me, that recognition to just get Bitcoin. And I don't know. So yeah, I started to, you know, go down that rabbit hole of like, okay, well, now I have to, how do I acquire it? How do I store it? All this, like the typical, you know, Bitcoin journey. And that's kind of when I realized like, yeah, I can stack for myself and sure, I can maybe provide a little bit of that, you know, for my, my children, but that really doesn't solve the problem for them. So it's just kind of like, the analogy is just like the oxygen mask on the plane. Like, yeah, you put yours on first, but then you don't sit down, you know, like you put yours on first and then you help others. Like you be a leader. Like that's the, like, here's a problem and leaders direct collective action towards ends. You know, leadership is moral. So it was like, that became my moral duty, to start thinking about orange pilling. Like, okay, why is this so hard to orange pill people? Like, why is Thanksgiving such an awkward conversation with your uncle? You know, like I just couldn't accept that 99% of the people that don't get Bitcoin are dumb. You know, like to me, I'm always reflecting back at myself saying, well, what's my part? And it became real obvious to me because I'm understanding that money is moral before it's economic. So we're using the wrong tool. Like we're spitting all this economic macro garbage at our uncle. Well, not garbage. We're spitting all this data at people saying, don't you get it? And they're like, I don't even care about this. Like that's not a shocking thing to me that no one cares about the economics. Like no one wants to march through that marsh. Like I don't blame them for that. So it's like, it's kind of like, from my perspective, we're orange pilling people like a miner. We're just like raw computational data and we're just hoping to catch a block. Like, and sure, that might work for a couple people, but like, that is not a good strategy. You know, like I got Bitcoin like a node. Like I validated the logic. I recognized the moral, you know, like, I recognize that it's valid. And it's just such a, you know, that asymmetry between the amount of work that you're asking someone to do, because you're not going to do it for them. Like you can't orange pill someone for them. They have to do it themselves. But why am I going to ask them, hey, you have to hit a block to get Bitcoin, or just say, hey, validate the chain, validate the logic. Like that's, so that's kind of my whole point of what this book is supposed to be. Like this is my, my attempt to contribute what I can, you know, some leadership, some philosophy to arm Bitcoiners with the moral language so they can help talk to their loved ones about Bitcoin. Cause like I don't really care if, you know, BlackRock and all the crazy people, if they buy all the Bitcoin and we send it to, you know, 50 million, a billion a coin, like I don't care so much about that as I care about let's get a million families onboarded to Bitcoin so that they can, like, I want a healthy society. Like I want to make sure that families can have homes and raise kids and like that's what I'm focused on. So it's like that's my strategy. I'm approaching this just like I would any other military operation. Like if I'm planning an engagement, I'm looking at the map, I'm analyzing the terrain. I'm trying to create this asymmetrical, advantage. I'm trying to maximize that where I have the biggest advantage and my enemy has the worst disadvantage. And then I'm trying to strategize the how do I funnel them into that spot where I get to choose when I engage with them. And to me, it's like this moral high ground that that's the highest spot on the battlefield. Like slavery is indefensible. There's no moral justification for it. So I'm not going to do anything else. I'm going to push that. That is the sink. Like that is the little stone that David slings at Goliath. Like you ask the politicians, you ask your uncle at Thanksgiving, justify debasement. Like you think about that and you come up with the answer. There is no answer. So it's just like, that's what I don't care about sounding like a smart boy. Like I don't want to get up and wow people with stuff. I just want to win. I want Bitcoin to, Bitcoin will do what Bitcoin does, but I can do what I can do. And I care about my family. I care about the people in my community and I want them to get Bitcoin too. So I'm just shouting macro at them and telling them they're stupid. Just seems really dumb. So I'm going to meet them where they are. They're a moral agent. I'm going to speak moral language to them. And, like that's my strategy for how to start onboarding families. And I don't want to win I don't want to win by decision after 12 rounds. Like I just want a first round knockout. Like,
yeah, you know, Neil, I love this. I love how you tee this up and we do have some hands. So I do want to go to the hands, but I just want to say to everybody in the space, like if you've been listening to me for any length of time, you know, I'm a TradFi guy. So I like the numbers. I like the data. I like diving into those things. I like looking at trends, all of that stuff. But one of the main reasons that I love this book and I love what Neil's talking about is because what Bitcoin has done for me is it has made me open my eyes to new things. And just because the numbers and the data and the macro is comfortable, I think I identify with what Neil's saying, which is that stuff doesn't necessarily translate well when you're talking to Normieville, as I'll call it. And so the reason I like it is this conversation and Tomer's Sunday space is because it challenges me, takes me out of my comfort zone. And I'm no philosopher by any means, but I love to be challenged in my mind. And so this isn't for everybody. So if you don't like it, drop from the stage. It's okay. I'm not offended. We're not mad. We love you. And we can talk about macro tomorrow when infra's in here. But
yeah, today, and I'm not saying that it doesn't work for some people or it doesn't have a place. I'm thinking about the normal person. Approach.
Exactly. Yep. So let's go to BFP and then we'll go to Tomer and then anybody else who has questions or comments based on what Neil has presented so far.
Yeah, I had a question for Neil. I love everything you're saying and I'm going to get the book, but the metaphysics word you were using, I kind of understand it. It's a little esoteric or hard to understand. So I just wanted to get your definition of what you mean by the metaphysics you're saying from first principles and stuff like that.
Yeah. So I try to do a good job in the book of really making it accessible and laying it out. But I mean, basically all meta, because it is a scary word and I don't want to scare people off, because you do it all, everybody does it every day. But metaphysics is just like the question, like, what does it mean to be? Like, how is it that anything exists at all? And the super short, succinct answer is that the only coherent metaphysical kind of approach is this, like, this hylomorphic answer. So it's like, act and potency both coming together. It's like, or form and matter. It's like, we can talk about, like, just like we did with the money, how, like, there's the material object, there's its, you know, material attributes, but then there's this form, this immaterial aspect to it, and it's putting them both together that describes reality. So that approach is, when I say, like, metaphysically grounded, it just means I won't stop unless I have a hylomorphic answer at every step. Like, if that's kind of my, like, little, my gauge. If I don't have a hylomorphic answer, if I'm not accounting for the material and the form, if I'm not accounting for the subject and the object, act and potency, then I know that I'm only getting a partial truth. Like, it's not to say that I can't explore, you know, like in the book, we just look at the material stuff and we just look at the formal stuff, because it's good to go in depth and get the details in that. But if I'm not putting them back together for my answer, then I haven't done the work yet. So that's all I kind of mean by, grounding it in that metaphysics, is like, it just, I have to have a hylomorphic answer. I have to account for both, or else I'm not going to progress to the next stage of inquiry. I don't know if that helped you or not, answer your question.
Yes, appreciate it.
Tomer, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. And go ahead with any commentary or questions.
Yeah, it's wonderful to listen to someone else whose anchoring of Bitcoin is not number go up, but is the ethical foundation for it. And so welcome, and really nice to meet you, Neil. I thought maybe we could get a bit of a dialogue going, but it's not like you said anything that I disagree with. I'm a big fan of Aristotle as well. And maybe some of our other academic or philosophical studies have taken us in slightly different directions, but we've ended up in the same place. I did share, I wrote a series about 3 years ago that I called Who Are the Bitcoiners? And it was very much about trying to get at the character of Bitcoin, the ethics of Bitcoiners. And I shared one short article from it in The Nest, which is called Rich or Poor, Bitcoiners Have What Money Can't Buy. And I was reminded of it listening to you tell your story, because in it, I point out what steps people need to go through to become a Bitcoiner and how that builds character. And it sends them down the philosophy rabbit hole, the ethics rabbit hole, the what is money rabbit hole. So very much describing your journey and how it strengthens their character as a result, and enriches them financially at the same time, because they put their money where their mouth is and buy Bitcoin. And so they end up having money, but they also end up having what money can't buy, which is conviction, friendship, love, understanding, and an ethical basis by which to live their life. So you may enjoy that. It's written, not in the form of a essay, but maybe a little bit more prose-like. I don't really know if there's anything more that I would add. I would maybe just stress again, you know, I will add one counter to one of the things that you asked, which isn't a counter I agree with, but it is like, when you say to people, isn't slavery immoral? They will say yes. And you say, well, taxation is slavery. Debasement is slavery. I can demonstrate to you how it's debasement. You will find that psychologically they come back with some variant of the, but who will build the roads and who will protect the nation if they don't tax or debase? And it's all rationalized and justified through democracy, as if the majority rule, you know, the majority has the right to enslave the minority. And so I think that people are really indoctrinated with a lot of these ideas, that even when you confront them rationally and indisputably with objections to debasement, as your example, and the pointing out that it's an equivalency to slavery, you still don't end up persuade, you know, you still don't overcome their objection because they have this, yeah, but what's the solution if we aren't all forced to surrender our property to the state? And you may end up able to engage in a conversation of degrees, how much slavery is appropriate. But once you concede the premise that slavery has to be tolerated, not because it's moral, but because we can't figure out how to work things otherwise, because we haven't lived in an otherwise different situation, many people's imagination or, you know, confidence in trying to step out of that system and disappears.
Yeah. So I do kind of address this in the book. My response would be this. So when we're talking about moral crimes, like Aquinas is taught, he defines moral crimes by the object that is like taken. So if we use murder, like it's the wrongful, immoral taking of another's life. Like stealing is the wrongful taking of property, an object, and slavery is, you know, that taking of their work, that taking of their productive energy. So what I try to do in the book is say, like, listen, when we have to be precise, like when people use slavery and taxation, and stealing all kind of interchangeably, that's too general. And that's not the point we're making. So like, debasement is equally murder as it is, theft. If that makes sense, like to me,
yeah, the way
I'm just thinking.
Murder takes all of my time. Slavery takes 50% of it. You know.
I'm by focusing on the object that's being taken, I'm drawing a clear delineation between the two. So I'm not dealing in a more or less. I'm dealing in a category of, it's creating like a category of belonging. Like slavery is distinct and separate from stealing. And it's separate and different than murder. And so by that, I guess that's my, I'm literally just trying to carve out the slavery portion to make the situation even less complex. So for someone to say, well, it's kind of, well, you have to, what can we do about slavery? Cause we still have taxes. Like I'm saying, well, those two things aren't the same. Like categorically. So I'm just going to push that to the side and we'll deal with that later. Like the slavery portion, the debasement portion, like I want to break the chains first and then we can talk about everything that comes after that. But I don't know if that maybe helps clarify.
I think for most people, for maybe many people, you know, the people you're going to have these conversations with, they will have a difficult time distinguishing categorically, whether there is a categoric difference between taxation and debasement. In both cases, they worked hard for money and their money has less purchasing power as a consequence of that action, right? If it's 20% taxes or 20% debasement, you know, there's just a little bit of math involved there, but it's the same theft of the product of their work.
Yeah, I would say the outcome is, but there's the moral classification is different. Like if I take $20 from your wallet, I'm taking an object from you. I'm taking your property. I'm stealing that bill. But when you debase money, you're not taking any property. Like there's no transfer of a physical object. It's literally just the extraction of that value. And when you pay taxes, I mean, you're writing a check to the IRS. You get a bill, you know, so it's like, even though we might conflate the effect kind of like, oh, we're looking at like, in all three cases, the same thing happens to me, but it's like, but they're not morally equal. I guess that's my only point.
I don't want to take this conversation into the ditch.
I understand what you're saying. I agree. Most people will hit that bump.
Yeah. And they'll respond by saying, well, you know, I don't actually write a check to the bank, to the government. My employer, complying with the slave master's, orders, they're the delegated slave master of me and I work. And instead of paying me 100% of what I earn, they pay 20%, 40%, 50% to the slave master. When I go shopping and there's a sales tax, it's not like I'm writing a check to the government. I'm trying to buy something and they forbid the seller from selling it to me free of sales taxes. And it goes on and on and on, right? Like, so I think that there, like, I agree with you that there can be categorical distinctions made on which one of these things looks more like slavery, which one looks more like theft. Why are they all immoral? Right. And it's, you know, it's different kinds of, but similar forms of immorality. And the thing I want to come back to is not, oh, are they both slavers, one theft and one slavery? These are all immoral things that people tolerate either because they don't feel they can fight back or because they've been, what's the word? Domesticated is perhaps not the pacified to the point of saying, well, you know, it's not that bad. I don't mind being 50% a slave because the slave master in return gives me protection. He gives me police. He gives me a military. He gives me roads. He gives me free flags, like celebrations and fireworks shows. And so people aren't thinking through what they might do otherwise. They're not inspired to act with greater freedom or with full freedom. And I think that is one of the biggest obstacles that I find in trying to have dialogues like over Thanksgiving dinner with people who are long-term skeptics who've heard of Bitcoin. They know it's made a lot of money for a lot of people. They view it as that. You try to pivot the conversation into an ethical one. And for the same reason that people vote for governments that are going to raise taxes or keep taxes the same, or even only lower them slightly, you get the same rationale. There's a moral deference, a moral surrender to what can easily be painted as an immoral activity, proven to be an immoral activity, and yet people will tolerate it.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I guess, you know, this stuff is, like I've said before, for me, like, I'm more of a numbers guy, so I love the brain stretching activity that it is, and I love it that you guys can kick this around out of my league for sure. But, you know, it does get me thinking, like, why is it that people will voluntarily do this? Or is it just that the voices or the propaganda, as it may be called, is so strong? Or did we just get here by accident? Like, what do you guys think? You know, I'm looking at this from like a morality standpoint, like you guys are saying, but like, what got us here? Do we have any?
Well, history got it. I'll let Neil answer and then I'll try to go, unless that was somebody else going.
Well, yeah, real quick. I mean, and Tomer, you kind of touched on it. To me, it's fear got us here. It's like at the base of all this stuff is, in my mind, is a fear of, you know, who will build the roads? How, you know, as humans, we have this just, you know, fear is part of our emotionality and part of our everyday life. And if you don't control that or understand that, then it's like, realize that that's a big part of why you're making a lot of the decisions you're making. Then that's exactly how we got here.
Yeah. I would also add, like, I think that there's an emotional context to it, but what got us here is history. And in particular, it's political history. The history of politics has, the more you study it, the more, especially with this idea in mind that I'm about to share, the more you realize, well, this has been consistent. There's this notion of leadership or rulers and the ruled, whether it was framed as slaves and enslavers or just kings and subjects or presidents and voters. There's always been this idea of there's the ruled and then the rulers. And we thought, in the giant Democratic Republic Revolution that took place from the end of World War I up until the collapse of the Eastern Europe communists, that democracy was a solution to the problem of the ruled versus the rulers, because anybody could try to become a ruler, and they could be voted out in short order if they weren't good. So we thought that that was a good system. But ironically, it turned out to be a very vulnerable system with weaknesses that got exploited increasingly over time. And the root problem with it is the rulers still dispose of the assets of the work and goods of the ruled. They just are encouraged to do so much faster because they're only in power for 4 to 8 years, and they don't have to live with the consequences of what they create, of the problems that they created. They don't have to pay the debts that they incurred. So they're actually less responsible than monarchs would have been. And we're really feeling the pressure of it now. Everybody comes in, they generate a bigger debt than anybody else did. Somehow through all the flood of money back and forth and crises that are created and addressed and this and that and the other, they leave office and they're somehow multi-billionaires or have hundreds of millions of dollars. And that's, you know, and so you were like bonus enslaved for all the misdirection that they put in. To make you not see that you were enslaved. So I think like political history plays a big part in it. I think one of the parts that Bitcoin can play in this, or two that are kind of one economic, one moral or metaphysical at the same time, is because it's seizure resistant, when you do obtain Bitcoin, it can't be debased and it can't be taxed except for through your writing of the check at that point, right? So I think that that's one of these really important distinctions. And as I try to maintain my train of thought, because I'm going through a bunch of ideas here, what was the other point? I thought I had it and then I just lost it. So I mean, I'll let someone else jump in and it'll come back to me in a minute, but the last thing is, in Bitcoin, there are no rulers. Sorry, this is a very important point. It's a very different political structure than any political structure that has existed before. There's only one rank, and that is peer or participant. Those are the two words that Satoshi uses in the white paper. It's not that we're all equals in intelligence, in our wealth, in this, that, the other. We're all equal before the rules. The rule of law, the rule of code as law, applies equally to everyone in Bitcoin and forever will. And we don't vote people in to change laws and make new laws and change the regulation. There's not, that notion isn't there. And we don't see, through succession planning, leaders take over from other leaders, which has been the political history of all of the political systems we've ever seen before. Gold did have this same characteristic, except for the, you know, of everyone who holds it according to the same rules. But one of the rules of gold is it's not seizure resistant. And so people would go to war and commit violent crimes against each other over gold. And so gold has a very bloody and long history of violence and murder. So that's where it disconnects from this moral claim that Bitcoin actually, I think, will be able to, it holds on to today and will likely be able to hold on to forever. So that's what makes it unique in history. It's a different political engagement. The first one that's actually peer to peer. Don't bother trying to change the rules. You're not a ruler. Nobody else is either. So you can relax about that. And it's seizure resistant resistance means that you get to keep it, to do with as you choose according to your free will rather than according to the people with power, influence, and whether they're kings or elected politicians or thugs or gang leaders and whatnot. Okay. That's my tirade. Sorry.
No, that's great. And I did want to give Neil a chance to respond and then go to 23 Skidoo. See you're up on the stage, sir, but go ahead, Neil.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's some great stuff, that Tomer was spitting. That's, I just wanted to answer that kind of how I do that in the book. So, answering that question of like, how did we get here? Why do we put up with it? And it's like my approach, I was like, okay, so if this is slavery, right, and slavery is this form, and it's kind of like it's just changing thing throughout human history. So it's like in one of the chapters I go through, you know, basically drawing that, connecting that following that cord or that thread of formal slavery from, you know, Mesopotamia all the way, you know, to today. And it's just like, when you understand that if that function moves and changes, it's like, okay, well, like the question we're talking about, well, why do people put up with it? I was like, well, that too would probably have to be connected and the same. And this is where I came across some of Frederick Douglass's stuff, and I think he really nailed it with he makes this distinction between the house slave and the field slave. And he just nails it. It's comfort. You know, we talk about fear and, but it's like the comfort is like the flip side of that, that coin. You know, our lives are too comfortable, and meaninglessness too. Like when they strip you of your meaning, you don't really have a reason to like buck the system anymore either. Cause you're just like, so you're just this comfortable, empty, hollow husk. And they just farm you. Like that's like, I don't know. So I pulled off Frederick Douglass, and there's one of the later chapters is literally just exploring that, how that works in our daily life and our lived reality is just this comfort, this pacifier is what keeps people like the chains are now velvety and soft and they're super light, but they're still performing the exact same function. And you know, like that's with this nominal gain stuff, like, real terms are the only thing that matters. Like the value inside, the purchasing power, like what the money can actualize. Like if you talk about, you know, the value is the thing that helps you actualize that end. It's like, well, what's the power of your money? And the power is just getting drained and drained and drained. And the number goes up and up and up. And people are fixated on the number, not realizing that, you know, its power, like the thing that's important, its essence is actually, you know, just getting diminished, vaporized. But I don't know. That's all. I just wanted to share that in the book itself, like that is a very key. It has, you know, multiple chapters to actually parse that out and lay it out. So to help people get, cause it's like, well, how you have to get somebody to, trade in this comfortable lie for an uncomfortable truth. And my, kind of coming from the philosophy, it's like, I do believe that every human being as a moral agent has that inherent dignity to like innate in them, but they also have an ability to enhance and extend that dignity through their actions. So it's just like, I think when you go to somebody and you meet them where they are and you say, look, these are the abuses that are being done to you. It's dehumanizing you. It's, you know, it's stripping you of your human dignity. And you can tell them that and say, hey, and this is how you can reclaim it. Like just pushing all the other numbers aside and just fixating on that, like be human. Like you are sovereign. Just, you have to just stand up. Open your eyes, see it, and do it. Like, I think that's the more coaxing or compelling. Like, I want to lead people. I want to, you know, it's not just telling them stand up, but kind of like I'm standing up with them. It's like, you can do it. Come on. Like that. I don't know. That's the military side of me coming out. Like, that's what we do. You know, you don't leave them behind and you try to rouse their spirit or, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. I want to come across, I want to be really clear. Like I live my life according to that, to all the tenets you just described. And in so doing, I've come across a lot of people who I would say are demure to letting things happen to them. They will collaborate with the oppressors for fear of losing their comfort. It's a common meme in the Bitcoin community to describe them as that character Cypher from The Matrix, who betrays all of his fighters in The Matrix in order for a comfortable life. So people do make that choice consciously. And some of them even become very offended when you say, be a human being, because the response is, are you telling me I'm not a human being? And you're saying you're not living up to the potential of what a human being is, because a human being acts with freedom and doesn't exploit other human beings and lives to the best of their potential. And it's like, are you telling me I don't do these good things and I do these bad things? And it's like, and at the end of the day, you have to say yes. In the modern context, and this is where your integration to the word, like slavery is such an offensive word, right? To say to somebody, you are a slave. And you are collaborating with the slave masters, or you are a slave master and you're enslaving millions of people. It is such a shock. like even what, even if you make the whole argument and then you, you cash in by making that connection, suddenly all the ego pops up and all the defense mechanisms kick in and say, there must be something wrong with your argument. I'm not a slave. I'm free. I voted in the last election. I just went to Disney World. How can you tell me that this is the life of a slave? And so it's very, like, it's hard to hold that frame, against people's preconceived perceptions.
Yeah, which is why it's important to just nail that debase, because you're being debased. You are, like, that's the mechanism of your enslavement. And Frederick Douglass talks about that too, how like the house slaves are the best enforcers. Like,
yeah,
I did want to get
to, that's why it's not easy to orange pill people.
It's true. I did want to get,
we're not going to get them all.
His arm's getting tired. Let's let him chime in here.
Yeah, man, it's shaking. It's shaking. Wow, what a great conversation. Thank you so much. So much to be said. I wish I was just hanging out with you all at a party, having some beers or drinks and just going on for hours, because this topic is so dear at heart, and it's been really what, you know, the field, if you will, or the meta space that my entire adult life has been in since I was like 16, volunteering at anarchist centers and like looking at the population and trying to tell people, you know, as Tomer said, as Neil said, like, no, we're slaves, you know, look at this. And the life we live is at the cost of so many other people on the planet due to, as we talk about now in Bitcoin, the dollar's power and currency. And that's why I became a Bitcoiner so fast. But the one difficult thing, the whole conversation has morphed since I raised my hand a little bit, but the whole conversation now, just talking about freedom and slavery, I mean, the whole thing that I've had to navigate and come to terms with my whole life is that, like, yes, I consider myself an anarchist, and I say that loosely, I'm not stuck on it, but I'm done with the idealistic, like, anarchism will work for everybody. No, it won't. Because the majority of people are slaves and actually want to be slaves. I mean, yes, if you talk to them, they'll kowtow to all the ideals of freedom and privacy and all these things. But their actions, the way they walk, say that they would rather have convenience at the cost of freedom on all fronts, on all levels of everything in life. So, as a freedom maximalist walking in this life now and living and trying to share and trade and work with people as equals, I have to come up against and rub against the friction all the time that I'm interacting with in the economic world I'm interacting with and the technical world I'm interacting with doesn't want to be free, has no interest in freedom, has no interest in righteousness and health and all these things. So I'm left now with, how do we now in this modern age, it throws back on the beginning of Bitcoin, we need to be cypherpunks, cypher anarchists. We need to create systems that we can coexist and interact with as much freedom as possible amongst the pools and tides and waves of people that do not want to be free. No revelation there. I mean, we've all thought that.
No, it's a really powerful point, because there are people who will say, we have to destroy fiat. We have to wake everybody up. And
not happen.
And I think that that's the pragmatic point. You know, people say the perfection is the enemy of the good. Like,
right.
We are giving ourselves and every other person in the world the choice to shake off their chains, to go with the metaphor of the book. And anyone can do so at any point in time. They just have to run a node and exchange their fiat for Bitcoin. And it's not, you snap your fingers and you're instantly free, but you study and you accumulate Bitcoin and you awaken and develop the skills of being a free person. And we don't have to free everyone in the world. And I think that that expectation that we free everyone and equalize everyone is kind of like what got us to a situation where we have the majority of people voting for their own, for theirs and everybody else's enslavement. And so we need a system that we can get out of not by persuading everybody that self-enslavement is bad, but by giving an exit door to the people who don't want to be a part of
it. Exactly. Yeah, just spreading that circle. And, you know, as I kind of realized a long time ago, it's like no, you know, young, idealistic, all that, waiting for quote unquote the revolution or something. It's like, fuck it. No, there is no revolution. The revolution is internal. And then as much as possible, you mimic the external with the internal freedom. Revolution has already happened. I'm already free. I'm already sovereign. And I'm now co-creating with other people that are free and sovereign. I'm not being a dumbass. I understand I live in this world of consequences and of government and of all this shit. But as much as possible, I'm already free. The revolution's already here. And now I just have to deal with the shit around me and find and coexist with the most free people that already exist and with the most free money.
I'm just trying to leave space for someone else to speak because I've been monopolizing the dialogue for the last 10 minutes.
Thanks for letting me rant, though.
Good rant.
Bob, we lose you? Guess so. It's my show now. It's Tomer's show.
One of us bored him to death. Or to sleep, at least.
Well, hey, I got a quick technical question, just not to change the whole conversation. Maybe Bob will get back on and steer it. But, you know, I'm trying to quote unquote live on a Bitcoin standard as much as possible, doing stuff like bit refill and using prepaid cards that I load up with Bitcoin, which is a bit of a misnomer because, you know, we're not spending Bitcoin directly. It's a second tier way of spending USD in exchange for Bitcoin. But I would assume, so the technical question is this, I would assume that when I load up a prepaid Visa card through BitRefill or Aqua Wallet and these kind of mediums, that this is a tax event that needs to be tracked because it's somewhat removed one step from buying the products with Bitcoin. Does anybody know if buying the prepaid Visa card with Bitcoin is a tax event?
I have no idea. Looks like we lost Bob. I'm sure we'll come back soon, but no, we'll try to keep it on. I guess we're coming up actually to the top of the show. So without Bob, we'll just kind of close it out. I think we had a great conversation. Neil, thank you so much for coming on. Let's see, you've got your Twitter. Where else? I just bought your book on Amazon, so I'm excited to dig in a little more and read it. But is there any other way people can get in touch or buy the book? What's the best way? Where do you get the best bang for your buck, buying the book?
So everything that I have, just like modernchains.com, I have all the stuff there. Like I got Noster, QR codes and all that stuff. So if anybody's interested in anything like that, I mean, that's where that is, just modernchains.com. I just got all my books, like the bulk order. So if anybody wanted to buy a book for Bitcoin or whatever like that, I mean, just message me or whatever and I can hook that up. I'm actually halfway through Orange Pilling the publisher. He's thinking about trying to figure out how to set, you know, book for Bitcoin up on his end. So we're going to see if we can do that. Cause I would like to move to that standard. I don't know, just getting it published in the normal channels seemed to be like the right thing to do for normal people. Cause they'll, I don't know.
Terrific. Neil, I'd like to invite you on Bitcoin Today, which is another Twitter Spaces that happens at 11:30 a.m. Eastern every day. Not necessarily today, but I'll talk with the other folks on there because I think you've got a very solid idea. It was nice to hear you express it, and I'm sure people would love to listen to it on that Spaces too. So just DM me and we can coordinate.
Sure. Would love it.
Yeah. You know what I'll say? I think it's, and I'm back. So, what I'll say is I did find it quite hilarious when Tomer heard Neil for the first time, and you could tell there was like this hesitation in his voice. It was almost like when you're walking your dog and it comes up against another dog and they kind of size each other up, and then they're just like, they touch noses. Like it just, it was quite beautiful. And you know,
I was literally walking my dog, and that happened while I was listening to this. So
these spaces are a beautiful thing. And so I just love this conversation, guys. Neil, really appreciate you coming on. Yeah. Tomer, for the last minute, coming up, and all you guys that listen to us every day at 10 a.m. We do have to close it out, but I do think we can do this again. And yeah, Neil, I would encourage you, if you've got the time, it'd be awesome to have you on Bitcoin Today. I'm sure some other spaces would love to take up this topic. I know this morning show doesn't fit in everybody's schedule, but for those of us that it does, it was a real pleasure having you up here. I'm sure we'll have you up here again. And yeah, you're welcome anytime. People, follow this guy, get his book. It'll stretch your brain a little bit. And I know it has mine already, and I haven't even finished the whole thing. So.
Hey, can I ask real quick, Neil? Looking at your site right now, I'm not actually seeing a way to buy it with Bitcoin. I see a QR code for tips. Am I missing something?
Yeah, no. So I just got I have a big box of books. I was just like, if someone wanted to do that, just like message me and we'll work something out where I'll just mail it to you. Like,
okay.
I have to do that indirectly, like just one-on-ones, but like, I'll meet somebody. If someone wanted to get the book for Bitcoin, I mean, whatever, like that just like tickles me pink. So I would.
Well, hell, man, that should be the only way we're all buying it. Come on, for sure.
Yeah.
Not come on to you, but come on to all of us. That should be all we're doing.
But it's awesome. It's really guys. More about the message.
Yeah, for sure. But I do think that the book can be a good tool, right? It's something that people can kind of reference back to besides this conversation. And I do think it's a great tool. So, pick it up, reach out to Neil, or, it is on Kindle, on Amazon, if you want to support that beast. But, guys, this was amazing. And again, really love the change of topic a little bit in this space. We'll try to do more of these. We'll try to get Neil back, Tomer back. Would love to hear, Neil, either on Bitcoin Today or Tomer's space on Sunday mornings, if that would work. But yeah, thank you guys so much. This is, again, mind-bending, mind-stretching, I think, for a lot of us. A little bit different change of pace here on this Thursday. Do want to encourage you guys, if you need help on your Bitcoin journey, visit BitcoinVeterans.org. Plug your information in. We'll get you plugged in to helpful resources to help you on your Bitcoin journey. But that's all we have for today. It was a wonderful Thursday. Great guest. And great stage and great listeners. We'll do it all again tomorrow at 10 a.m. But remember, please, please, please do not shitcoin. You'll live to regret it. I guarantee it.
People that use fiat currency as a store of value, we call them poor. We call them poor.